Hello and welcome to Volume 12 of Capital Ideas Live. One of the assumptions of the environmental movement is that harvesting results in irreparable damage to the landscape. And one of the fears of forest industry is that demand for timber will outpace supply. These twin concerns find expression in the idea of forest sustainability. Jan Kofil believes that the current movement to certify forests as sustainable presumes that American forests are badly managed and declining. Jan Kofil is one of my guests on this issue of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll also discuss a surprising finding concerning how clear cuts may actually be very effective in promoting clean water. We'll also discuss conservation easements, casualty losses, a perpetual harvest system, tree identification, living in the woods, and timber markets, all on this issue of Capital Ideas Live. I'm Hayes Brown, the General Counsel for the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. Our first guest is Dr. Jan Kofil with Timbervest, a forestry consulting firm. Welcome, Jan.
Good morning.
You know, the woods are full of those who welcome forest certification. Environmentalists, some consultants, and even forest industry have joined in the chorus. But you've voiced a concern over this issue in a recent article. Can you tell us what motivated you to write a paper on forest certification?
Sure. Over the last few years, just about any forestry publication you pick up has at least one article on forest certification. And when we talk about certification, we're referring to a third-party opinion, sort of like an audit from an accountant, as to whether a forest property is being managed in an appropriate or a sustainable manner. In other words, whether good forest management practices are being followed. Now, most of what you've seen published about certification describes it very positively. The majority of writers assume either explicitly or implicitly that America's forests need to be certified. Now, if this were true, it means that our forests are degraded, they're in poor condition, and they're being managed poorly. So our first objective in writing this paper was to see if it actually was true. Now, it turns out it's not. Published data, mostly Forest Service data, shows pretty clearly that over the last century, America's forest area actually increased. Over the last half century, the total growing stock volume rose, in other words, the volume of trees out there. And the volume of growing stock in large diameter trees increased as well. The other thing that we found is that the area of non-stock forest also declined pretty dramatically, about 82%. And finally, contrary to a lot of statements that you see made by environmental groups, a very tiny fraction, about 5% of America's forests are in plantation. So simply put, America's forests are healthy, they're productive, and they're diverse. Now, our second objective was to compare three different certification systems, and we looked at the American Tree Farm System, the AF&PA Sustainable Forestry Initiative, and the Forest Stewardship Council, or FSC, certification system. And in the paper, we refer to these as the good, the sad, and the ugly. And I'd refer you to the paper to see why we say that.
So there appear to be different types, then, of certification systems, so a landowner should pay attention to which certification system is used.
That's right.
You've termed them the good, the sad, and the ugly. What are some characteristics of the ugly one? I guess that's the one you're terming the FSC system. What kind of implications would that have?
The FSC system really represents what I'm going to call a social engineering approach to certification. There's a lot of arbitrary and a lot of conflicting social goals built into the certification process. Landowner goals are very, very much a secondary consideration.
Mm-hmm. Well, then moving then next to the SAD system, the SFI, why do you refer to it as SAD?
It's SAD for a couple reasons. First of all, the American forest products industry as a group has done arguably a very good job in managing their forest lands over the last half century. And the way the AF&PA put together the Sustainable Forestry Initiative, the SFI, sort of It suggests an industry that has something to hide, by and large, they don't. Mm-hmm. They've done a very good job. The other reason I call it the SAD is because it's, frankly, somewhat arrogant. If you belong to AF&PA, you're required to comply with SFI principles, and there's nothing wrong with the principles. They're basically pretty good management principles, but I consider it a very arrogant approach to you know, working with their members.
It sort of buys into the need, the implicit need for certification.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's interesting. Thank you, Dr. Caulfield. We appreciate it. Leaving buffer strips around sensitive areas is something that during a harvest is a practice that's recommended for many, many years. Our next guest, Dr. Carlisle Franklin, with the North Carolina State Forestry School, has studied buffer strips, and by that I mean the areas next to cultivated fields. Dr. Franklin, what led you to speculate that clear-cutting in these buffer strips may actually have a helpful effect on removing things like sediments and nutrients?
Well, good morning. We had studied buffer zones around agricultural fields for about 10 years, and we discovered a couple of things. One was that about 80% of all sediments and nutrients are delivered by a few major storms each year. These storms would be characterized by, we commonly call them gully washers, very large volumes of strongly flowing water. And the first principle in detraining sediment from water is to slow the water down, reduce its energy, and deprive it of the capacity to carry sediment. And the structure, strong ground structure, vertical hardened structure on the ground is what most effectively decreases the velocity of rushing stormwater. And what we found typically is that a dense overstory of forest canopy does not let sunlight reach the soil, and typically you do not have a strong development of ground cover in a mature stand. And we, in our particular study, had a zone that was marginally effective. It wasn't quite big enough. It didn't have enough infiltration capacity for the serving field area. And so we had speculated that by clear-cutting that and providing strong ground structure, we could improve the effectiveness of the zone. And, in fact, that's what happened.
So it seems to be that the clear-cut develops ground cover, which then in turn slows water and reduces the energy of the water. Is that the benefits of the clear-cut?
Yeah, that's it. Of course, the other reason that forested filter zones function much better than grass filter zones is that forested filter zones have large macropore structure in the soil, stump holes, root channels, animal barrows, which allow large infiltration capacity. Grass zones and turf typically do not have that. So it's important to have some large trees in the forested filter zone. And so our recommendation, since many people don't like clear cuts, particularly our recommendation is if you have a mature zone, mature forest on a filter zone, is to cut it back on a partial cut to about 50% crown cover. And this will allow good ground structure development as well as maintaining some larger trees.
Okay, so a mixture of both of cutting and then some mature overstory.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Does this have implications for the regulation of streamside management zones? Because you've been talking first about the agricultural context, but what about streamside management zones?
Well, in terms of streamside management zones, at least in our neck of the woods, where they're typically mandated at 50 feet, by the time you have the opening from the stream side, and often you'll have some sort of opening on the managed side opposite the stream, this buffer zone is getting lots of light, side lighting, even if it's a closed canopy over the top. So it's not, the necessity to clear cut, I don't think the case can be made to improve that zone, because it's going to have pretty strong ground vegetation anyway.
So a 50-foot strip allows the side lighting then.
Right.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Franklin. We appreciate it. Our next guest is an alumni at Capital Ideas Live, Dr. Harry Haney. Welcome, Harry.
Thank you very much.
You've lectured on many topics, but today I wanted to ask you about conservation easements. Could you just tell me what a conservation easement is and how can I get one?
Well, first of all, a conservation easement is a contract, an encumbrance that runs with the deed. You could call it an agreement. And it's a form of land use control. Now, this is a very popular idea that is more or less sweeping the country, and it's related to what Dr. Caulfield commented on about timber supply. People want to preserve forest land and to arrest development. Associated with this are two goals, basically. And one is the landowner's idea or goal for protecting the land, and that is protecting it in a forested or open space arrangement so that it would be forever, more or less forever wild or forever managed as forest.
Mm-hmm.
And the second has to do with the tax benefits that are associated with this. And beginning in the 60s, the Congress has added more and more benefits, so now they're robust income, estate, and property tax benefits that go along with a conservation easement. Because conservation easements are permanent, that is a permanent encumbrance that runs with the land in most cases, it's very important for a landowner who's thinking of either selling or contributing a conservation easement to find a land trust or a public agency that has a philosophy that's compatible with his or her goals for that land. Because when you put your land under a conservation easement, you're giving up part of your rights. You're becoming, in effect, a co-owner with the grantee, that is, the land trust or the public agency. So it's very important to think carefully about the affirmative rights, that is, the rights that you're giving up to the grantee, and also, perhaps the most important from a landowner's point of view, are what we call reserved rights. These are the rights that the landowner reserves for himself or herself regarding the property. And that, for forestry, that has to do with being certain that you have kept your options available for managing your land according to your goals and according to your long-term objectives.
Well, it sounds like it's a contract that's entered into by the landowner. Does the extent of the reserved rights affect how much tax relief a landowner would get?
Well, importantly, it has to satisfy the IRS requirements under Section 170 of the Code. And that's a fairly detailed set of requirements. And because of that, it's very important, again, that the landowner work with his or her forester to make sure that they can practice forestry as their goals dictate. And second, it's important to see an attorney who's familiar with tax provisions to make sure that the deed or the agreement satisfies the IRS constraints or requirements so that you get the full tax benefits.
Okay. Well, you've written a book on that called The Landowner's Guide to Conservation Easements. And go ahead.
We have, and that's designed to alert the landowner to all the things that he or she could consider in getting a satisfactory deed. And a deed, it's negotiable, so you really have to sit down with the land trust and work through all these details. And that's why it's so important to think carefully about this in advance, get excellent professional advice. And in addition to the book, we're going to have a number of short courses, which I think will be available through the website at Auburn University next month, at Jackson, Mississippi, in conjunction with Mississippi State in November, as well as with the University of Georgia. And we'll have another one at Virginia Tech in the spring.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Haney.
You bet.
Our next guest is also an alumni to Capital Ideas Live, Dr. John Green with the U.S. Forest Service. Hello, John.
Good morning, Hayes.
John, last month you described for us the concept of casualty and non-casualty losses, and you also went over how to calculate a loss deduction. What I wanted to ask you today is whether a forest landowner can actually have a taxable gain as a result of a casualty or non-casualty loss. In other words, there's actually a gain resulting from a loss. Is this strange fact possible?
Right. If the timber that you had that was damaged or destroyed in the casualty or non-casualty loss is salvageable, you're obligated to make a genuine effort to sell it. So even if you receive a reduced price, a fire sale price, if you will, for the timber, it's likely that what you get is going to be higher than your basis in the timber. So you wind up with a taxable gain instead of a loss deduction.
All right. And if you do have a gain and it is possible to salvage it, is it true that you have to pay income tax then on the gain?
You can defer recognition of the gain and the tax on it by using the amount that you recover to purchase a qualifying replacement property within the allowable replacement period.
Okay, so it sounds like that's a way to avoid recognizing the gain by, you say, purchasing qualifying replacement property?
Right.
What does that term mean?
Okay, there's a whole list of things that qualifies as a replacement property. One would be a replacement timber site. Also, seeds and seedlings, the cost of replanting on a site that you own or lease or purchase, the cost of restoration work that you do to repair the damage, things like clean and clear drainage systems, replace culverts, repair fences, gates, and roads, even stock to acquire or gain control of a corporation that owns timber or timberlands or both.
Okay, so you don't necessarily have to buy a new property, but you can work within existing property to restore or plant other areas.
Right, even the cost of replanting the damaged site would qualify as a replacement property.
Okay, the site itself. Is there a time limit on this replacement property concept?
Right, the allowable replacement period is for casualty or non-casualty loss. It's 2 years after the close of the first tax year in which you realize any portion of the gain.
Okay, so it's not tied to when the damage occurred. It's tied to the end of the tax year.
Right, it's tied to the end of the tax year that you receive any gain from the damage.
Okay, receive any gain. What tax forms are used to report these casualty or non-casualty losses?
All right, if you have either a casualty or a non-casualty loss, you start on Form 4684, Section B of that form. You also, you want to use your Form T, your timber form, and that would be Form T Schedule D that you use to update your timber account volumes.
All right.
I said that wrong. You use that, and also you update your timber account volumes on Schedule F of Form T.
Okay, Schedule F of Form T.
Right. If it's timber that you hold as part of a trade or business, you go on then to Form 4797, Part 2 of that form.
Okay.
But if it's timber that you hold as an investment, you go on, instead of 4797, you go straight to Form 1040 Schedule A.
All right. So the forms you mentioned are 4684B.
Right.
And Form T, Schedule F.
Schedules D and F.
D and F, okay. Then if you're a trade or business, 4797.
Right, Part 2 of that.
Mm-hmm. And then investor uses 1040.
Schedule A.
Okay. Is this information summarized somewhere?
Well, it's everything that I've said is in Chapter 8 of the Forest Landowner's Guide.
Okay.
Also, the previous speaker, Harry Haney and Bill Siegel, are in the process of preparing a publication on frequently asked questions for taxes. This should be available soon.
All right.
And also, as a result of these talks we've been having, I'm developing a document that will be posted on the Southern Region Cooperative Forestry website. And y'all can link to that document when we get it all through the review process.
Okay. You have an idea when that might be? When it'll be completed?
I would hope within the next month.
Okay. Well, great. Thank you, John. We appreciate it.
All right.
The typical forest management plan involves planting, thinning, and a final harvest, usually a clear cut. And this process is known as a rotation. However, our next guest will discuss a harvesting selection system that does not involve a clear cut. Capital Ideas Live welcomes Dr. Ron Masters from Oklahoma State University. Hello, Dr. Masters.
Good morning.
Can you tell us how this selective management system works?
Well, to begin with, for the past several years, I was adamantly opposed to using any kind of selective cutting for regenerating, in particular, shortleaf pine or loblolly pine, just because of the ecology of the species. I felt like that they were better adapted to an even age management approach where you would conduct a clear cut and then just start to stand over, with loblolly being preferred for short rotation operations for pulp and fiber and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But with a selective cut, basically you're getting pulses, a private landowner will get pulses of income over time, depending upon the growth rate and upon site productivity of a given stand. In Oklahoma, the stands that we're working with have a site index of about 60 at a base year of 50. So they're not very productive sites compared to some of the coastal plain areas across the south. And from a landowner perspective, that steady supply, and that's relatively speaking, that's not every year, but you know, every 5 years, 10 years, whatever their regime is, the harvest regime within the selective cut stand, they can get some income over time.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the advantages that, that we have seen in recent years is that on low productivity sites, in terms of an economic analysis, it actually comes out a better rate of return carrying it through one rotation as compared to, say, planted loblolly, where you have a high-intensity site prep. And this is particularly important, I think, in areas where the SIP funds and FIP funds, the cost shares, are not available as they're drying up. So the landowners have to look at the cost of regeneration themselves, and that's where a selective system can have benefits.
So this system then doesn't involve a clear cut of the entire stand, but it involves moving over the entire stand at some point in time.
Right, in periodic increments, and that depends upon what you've got out there and then how your regeneration is staged.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, for short-leaf pine, we would want to get four age classes underneath that overstory canopy and develop those age classes and then start taking out the overstory a little more over time.
You had mentioned pine as well. One of the questions I'm going to ask you, is this a strictly hardwood system or a strictly pine system, or does it operate in both?
It operates in both, but particularly what we're talking about here is with pine trees. Most of the consultants in Oklahoma, Arkansas, in this particular region, and I imagine across the south, would recommend an even-aged harvest strategy, particularly going with loblolly or slash if you're down that far south. And what we're seeing on low productivity sites is that there may be better options in terms of economic return. And also, one of the things mentioned is the damage caused by a severe ice storm that we had that hit Arkansas and Oklahoma and Texas this past December.
Mm-hmm. There's also work in hardwood systems in addition to pine?
I would think so.
Mm-hmm.
But the pine seemed to be, this past year, more susceptible to the type of ice storm that we had than did the hardwoods.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Masters. Practicing forestry involves knowing what type of tree you have on your site and knowing what type of tree grows best on your site. And in order to do that, you need to know how to identify hardwood trees. Dr. Mike Golden of Auburn University knows how to do just that, and maybe he can help us. Welcome, Dr. Golden.
Good morning, Hayes.
Growing hardwood trees does require some knowledge of the characteristics of each type of tree, doesn't it?
Yes. Most of us realize that managing wisely and sustainably hardwood stands is somewhat more complicated than pine that most of us are more used to. And there's such a tremendous variety of hardwood species in the South. For instance, in Alabama, including non-commercial, we have more than 130 species that we would call hardwoods. And among the oaks, for instance, in Alabama, we have more than 30 species that occur or are planted. And these vary widely in value, in uses, in site requirements, and reproduction requirements. So particularly for natural regeneration, it's very important that you be able to identify the species you're working with and know their what we call silvical characteristics. And because you really have to have the species in the stand, in the overstory, but for many species, and the oaks being the prime example, for hardwood, you really have to have small trees, seedlings and small trees, present before you cut if you expect to get good regeneration.
Mm-hmm.
Now, but there are other species, however, if you know their silvics, for instance, yellow poplar, the ashes, and sweet gum, which the understory is not so such a strong requirement, but you do need them in the overstory. And in each case, knowing which species you have and their silvical characteristics is crucial for good management.
In order to know the silvics of a particular tree, you have to be able to identify it. Does Auburn
That's
University
right.
have any tools that we can use to help identify these different types of trees?
Yes. A member of our faculty, Dr. Lisa Samuelson, who teaches dendrology, which focuses on identification and characteristics of tree species. She has developed and maintains an excellent website that is linked, will be linked on your webpage, mm-hmm. It's currently linked. And it gives the species and pictures and characteristics of those species. It's an excellent source of that information.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Golden. We appreciate it. If you've ever fantasized about moving out of town and just living in the woods for an extended period of time, you'll be interested in our next guest, Wallace Kaufman. Hello, Wallace.
Good morning.
You've lived in the woods 10 times longer than Thoreau and reached exactly the opposite conclusions. Can you tell me about what you learned during the time, your time in the woods?
Well, it's interesting listening to the previous guest because it reminded me that most of the foresters I don't know, and I'm not speaking about the guest we've had this morning because I don't know most of them, but most of the foresters I know don't live in the woods themselves. They live maybe on a wooded lot or they live somewhere in the country. But one of the first lessons you learn if you really live surrounded by trees hanging over your roof and so on is that well, it's very beautiful. It's kind of like living with bears. It's both beautiful and dangerous. And the forest is not the romantic vision that a lot of people in a lot of environmental groups who live in big cities like to think it is. They think of it as they go walking for a day or two, and they think of it as a cathedral or the beautiful scenery that they have on the days when they're hiking the Appalachian Trail or taking a walk in the wilderness. It is all of those things, but when you live with it, summer, winter, fall, and spring, it's a lot more than that. Of course, it's the subject of the whole book of what I learned about it, but basically I've learned that it's in civilization, the technology, the kinds of things that the previous guests have talked about is where our hope of preserving forests in the way that we like them is going to be. People think of a woods as a romantic place, and when you get to know it, you realize that it's much more of a wild marketplace, a kind of what I call natural capitalism, than it is a kind of a cathedral or something or a sanctuary. And I've found that out when I've watched, for instance, after the 1996 hurricane clear cut essentially part of my property, taking down 200-year-old beeches and oaks and things like that. And then I watched the clearings begin to grow. And, of course, it's the competition at its wildest and most ferocious as the various species of plants try to get that natural capital, the energy and sunlight. And then for a while I was kind of mad about it, and I didn't like what nature had done to me. And then I stepped back, and I began to understand that this is a marketplace where the trees are competing for sunlight and energy, capital, you might want to say. And I began to intervene, cutting out some trees and saplings and encouraging others, trimming and so on. And I realized that it's like any other marketplace. The more you understand about it, the richer you're going to get, whether it's in some kind of spiritual richness or whether it's in economic return.
The woods are both beautiful but also complicated and chaotic at times.
Absolutely. And, of course, the chaos may have its own order, but we don't understand it entirely. And it's always encouraging on programs like this to hear folks come up with new research data, and that may not sound romantic to a lot of people, but I always find the more of these hard scientific facts I have, the more my awe and amazement about this system grows, its complexity, its resilience, and the surprises that are so much of the delight of living out here.
All right. Well, if you'd like to know more about Wallace's experience, you can purchase his book, Coming Out of the Woods, The Solitary Life of a Maverick Naturalist. Thank you for joining us.
Pleasure.
Returning again to Capital Ideas is Professor Tom Harris from the University of Georgia. Welcome back, Professor Harris.
Thank you, Hayes.
You're publishing TimberMart South, which is an authoritative timber market reporting service. Can you tell us what the last report shows? What indications are there?
Pulpwood prices generally are remaining weak. We had some slight recovery in most areas in saw timber prices, but the big story was weak markets for pine pulpwood.
What's causing the pulpwood weak market to remain so?
There are a number of factors. and let me just talk about some of the major ones. In most of the South, we're still suffering from dry weather, and that's made more timber accessible, and that's had a downward impact on prices. In a large part of the South, there's a lot of southern pine beetle activity, and that's bringing some salvage wood to the market. At the same time, a lot of landowners are shifting from a short rotation strategy to a longer rotation strategy and are trying to get some thinnings done, and that's intensifying the problem. We've got weak pulp markets on a worldwide basis. The pulp prices have dropped about $200 since the beginning of the year, $200 a ton.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's put profit pressure on the pulp producers, and that's carried through into the pressure on pine pulpwood. So, and hardwood pulpwood is also weak, although it's responded to some wet weather in the western part of the South.
Well, do you see any positive signs in today's market?
I think this is a good time to be accumulating inventory and only selling if absolutely necessary, is our advice to landowners at this point.
So it might be a buying opportunity for those who like to be forest
land. It certainly is.
Okay.
And there's lots of land on the market and timber on the market.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Harris. We appreciate it. Well, that's all the time we have for this issue of Capital Ideas Live. Our thanks go to Jan Caulfield, Carlisle Franklin, Harry Haney, and John Green. Thanks also to Ron Masters, Mike Golden, Wallace Kaufman, and Tom Harris. We hope that these guests have given you something to consider as you go about managing your forests in the way you see fit. With the clamor for regulation of forest practices, it's tempting to believe that forests are in a state of decline and that current practices harm the environment. However, it's a little-noticed fact that in Governing Magazine, Alabama was named among the top 10 states in the nation for drinking water. Local water systems are already providing clean, high-quality drinking water, and these results have been produced in the absence of extensive regulation of forest practices. So continue what you are doing. Improve where you see fit. And join us next month for the next issue of Capital Ideas Live. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown, thanking you for joining us.